Welcome to Solutions for the Underaffiliated, the show for people who want hope through examples of improving the overall health of humanity. My name is Eric, and today we have Lori Stradley. She's the Executive Director of Impact Health, and she's leading something called the Healthy Opportunities Pilot in Western North Carolina. And if you listened last week, you heard Lori describe the Healthy Opportunities Pilot during a rebroadcast of a show from February. The Healthy Opportunities Pilot is a five-year program, and it's focused on improving the living conditions that influence people's health the most. And the program supplements traditional care with offerings like free produce and transportation, and some are even investing in affordable housing. People who qualify for the program are assigned a care manager who assesses their health plan and need for the services, then connects the patients with community organizations that can help them. The program includes 29 or so service categories, from transportation vouchers and weekly produce boxes to parenting classes and help finding housing. And you can learn more at www.impacthealth.org. So Lori, does that pretty much describe it?
That's fantastic, Eric. I think I'm going to have to take you on the road with me. It's such a complex program project, and you just summed it up beautifully.
Well, I wanted to do that because I want to spend time focusing on the results. So it's been 6 months or so?
6 months since I was here last, but the first project launched in March of 2022. That's when we delivered first food box. And so it's been a little over a year of services slowly expanding and rolling out. And it's been, like every pilot, bumpy, but the impacts have been worth it. Phenomenal. I can share a few stories with you along the way, but it's been an incredible few months. And I joined the team in October, so I'm coming up on my year with the Impact Health team. And I just work with some really brilliant, compassionate, focused people who are really trying to change the landscape of healthcare in our region.
Talk a little bit about who's involved. Who are some of the players that you're bringing together?
Impact Health serves as something called a network lead. And that language is specific to the pilot. But what it really means is that we convene organizations across the region. Right now, we work with 52 separate community-based organizations that are in all of those areas you talked about: food service, transportation, housing. And most recently, we have begun working with organizations that focus on interpersonal violence and family safety, which is also a part of our work together. And we then connect the network lead. Our main focus are these community-based organizations, making sure they have everything they need to be stable and able to offer these services pretty quickly. And then we also work with the other stakeholders in the group. So prepaid health plans, that's the big shift in Medicaid transformation in North Carolina. We're moving to a managed care approach. So we work with the five private insurance companies that provide Medicaid in North Carolina. We work closely with DHHS, Department of Health and Human Services here in North Carolina, that supports the Medicaid infrastructure, but also allows for this innovation space we're all in. We also work with care managers. So that group is sort of a quiet behind the scenes group, but they are the backbone of how we're trying to approach this work. It's a person-centered approach, which is my favorite thing about it.
So the care managers, are they part of your team? Are they independent? Where do they come from?
A couple different places. We don't have care managers at Impact Health. We partner with them. Some of them are based at practices where your physician or your primary care office might be their care managers there. Some are a part of what are known as clinically integrated networks. Clinically integrated networks came about over the years of trying to recognize there are so many moving pieces in healthcare, and they need to be better organized. So clinically integrated networks work with practices, they work with insurance companies. So a lot of care managers sit there. And then the third place is in the insurance companies. So there are care managers that work directly with those managed care organizations to support people in connecting all the dots and getting everything they need.
And so do you coordinate them all, or how are they all coordinated?
That's a great question. I think of a lot of this as the, you know, you think about machines with all these interturning wheels, and when one turns, another does. And so we don't directly coordinate those, but we serve as a resource for them. So the main reason we work with care managers is to make sure that they know and trust all of these community-based organizations to provide great service to the individuals they're working with every day. So let's say you're a care manager and you get a referral from a family that has a child with asthma. And as the care manager works with that family, they discover that they have some carpet that needs to be torn up. But even in the middle of that conversation, they find out that they don't have enough food and they need to get access to regular, healthy, nutritious, local sometimes food. And so that care manager then needs to make referrals out to each of these community-based organizations to provide services. So our job is to make sure that those care managers know what's available, know where to go, who to trust, and then they have that relationship to say, I care about this person that I'm navigating their whole healthcare world with, and I feel good about sending them out to ASAP for their food box delivery or to Mountain Projects to navigate housing supports or Pisgah Legal because they need some advice on their housing and what their rights are.
So what are some of the goals? So understanding the process is really, really helpful. So we know what the care managers do and kind of who's involved. What's the end goal here and how are you measuring it?
When you do a demonstration project, and so this falls under a legal waiver called the 1115 waiver. We talked about that a little bit last time. And that is a petition from a state to Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to say, we want to run Medicaid a little differently in our state and see how it works. So the primary interest from Medicaid, so the very specific outcomes that they want to see are that the Medicaid dollars are being used more effectively. And typically what that means is that they see cost reduction with better health outcomes. So that is the sort of the core of what the Healthy Opportunities Demonstration Project is about. Impact Health is going to take it a little bit farther. We are also a community-based organization. And our interest is not only to make sure that these healthcare dollars are being spent well and that people are having great health outcomes, but it's also an economic driver in our region. A colleague of mine says that healthcare is about the only thing you can't outsource. It's here. We're taking care of people. The folks who are taking care of them are here. This project invests in over 200 jobs in Western North Carolina. So drawing those funds down into the community. And we've seen people who have gone from being Healthy Opportunity members to being employees of these HSOs because it is so meaningful to them, this work that we're doing. It's about stabilizing the social need infrastructure in our region. So when we draw down this new source of funding, which is Medicaid reimbursement dollars, we know that the organizations that often live on grants and donations now have a pretty consistent revenue stream, and it helps them not only serve this Medicaid population, but the folks they were already supporting. So we're measuring some of the economic impact. We're measuring job creation. We're measuring quality of service delivery. So we want to know that if you get a food box, that it's high quality food, that it's fresh, and that it meets the need of your family. So if you get a bunch of food you don't recognize, don't know how to cook, that's not really a quality outcome, because then what are you going to do with that food? And so our community organizations do a little bit of education. Sometimes they put recipes in the food boxes so that folks know what to do with it when they get it. They have conversations with folks. One of the social drivers, I think I mentioned this last time too, that doesn't get enough airtime, in my opinion, is social connectivity.
Right.
And that's not something CMS is interested in measuring, but we are. And so there's a group that we work with, Caja Solidaria, and their version of a food box is basically a drive-up farmer's market, where families get to select the foods that they want to have. So they know their tomatoes are in season. I'm going to make a tomato sauce tonight. And so there's member choice is another measure that we are interested in, because with support systems, you should always have dignity and the ability to tell us what you need and help us meet that need.
Well, so some of what you're talking about, people who are in a different financial situation take for granted, especially the social supports kind of thing. From a managed care perspective, you mentioned you're working with five. They think about things in a little bit different way. Tell us a little bit about the measures that, or whether you're considering the measures that some of these plans might consider important and what those measures might be.
The setup of the pilot right now is such that we don't have to worry as much about that. So the pilot dollars are passed through for our PHPs, the prepaid health plans. They don't have to worry as much about whether in that bucket of managed care money, if they are exacting how much money goes to housing versus cardiac rehab or those sorts of things. So right now we just get to look at all of it. But long-term, some of the things that we're thinking about are what of those 29, you're spot on, 29 fee schedule items. So that could be something like a food box delivery or a medically tailored meal, rental assistance, utility assistance. Those are all the things that get chunked out. Which of those are connected to the best health outcomes? So we are interested in that. We don't directly at the network lead level have access to the claims data. So SHEP's center at UNC Chapel Hill has the contract with the state to do that level of analytics, and we'll get that data over the next several months, maybe even a year, on where those most effective interventions live. We also recognize that there's going to be member choice in insurance selection. So if you are a Medicaid eligible, that you'll be able to choose which insurance product that you want to get into. And so there's going to be some market differentiation there that they need to promote. And one of the ways we see that in Medicare Advantage plans, for example, are things like Silver Sneakers Fitness Program. Right. Mm-hmm. So we know that the PHPs are going to make decisions based on cost effectiveness and on market differentiation, and probably a thousand other things that I don't know as a non-worker in that field. So we're concerned about those things. We want to make sure that these don't become value add. That's sort of the language of it's a nice to have. We want to make sure that it truly remains integrated within the care plan. And that's really loops back to that care manager, is that when they connect with a member, they lay out a care plan, and it's everything from, we need to get you in for your regular diabetes wellness check to make sure that your blood flow is strong, your HbA1c measure is right where it needs to be. And I recognize that to get you there, you're going to need access to regular healthy food delivery. You're going to need transportation to get to the gym, and you're going to need support getting back and forth to work so that you retain all of these benefits. And so that care plan is individually focused and helps keep that all together. And so we're optimistic that analyzing this intervention from the care plan model is going to be important.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about, if you could, you've kind of outlined the services. Can you flip it a little bit and say, here's what a person might be experiencing that they need someone to do all of these things? I mean, the care manager becomes someone who's really looking after all the social supports and probably helping them get to clinical care. So explain a little bit about it from the perspective of a member.
Yeah. And I think the good news here is it's going to shift too. So Medicaid expansion is coming, and the pilot will expand with it. So more people will be eligible for Medicaid, and more, and then those folks will then be eligible for healthy opportunities. So from the perspective of a member, there are a couple of different ways that they may come into this model. The original sort of clinical setup was that someone would go to their primary care doc and be identified as having a chronic condition that could be helped with access to social care needs. So in this experience, you would have a Medicaid member who comes in and is diagnosed maybe as pre-diabetic. And they would then be referred to a care manager if they're interested. So this always hinges on member choice. No one is forced to do anything or connect with anything. And that's really important because a lot of the populations that we're working with have a history of being mistreated by sort of the medical industry, or pushed to the edges of it. So they may not have a good working relationship with all of the sources that they have access to. One of those, so I'm going on all the side routes that we can always take with this. So they get connected with a care manager, and they have to complete, it's an assessment really, to help understand what they need and what they're eligible for. And then from there, the care manager will make referrals to one or more human service organizations. So the individual then gets calls. I had a conversation with someone yesterday who said, you know, often when you need resources, you have to chase them down. So if I'm a regular person that is really struggling, I'm going to make 25 phone calls to get two services. And then those still may not work. Ours reverses it. So the care manager makes a referral to the human service organization and they call you. They try to figure out what is the best time for a food box drop off, or what does your transportation need look like so we can find the best resources to connect it. So it's a little more like a typical referral. So let's say you need an x-ray and your primary care doc sends that out, and then the folks who are going to give you that x-ray give you a call.
And so then do the community services organizations that do that, all that outreach and kind of their own coordinating, mm-hmm. do they get reimbursed for that?
They do.
Okay.
That's been a huge shift since we spoke last. Two things. I think when I was here in February, we had a few hundred members that were getting access to these services. And we were drawing down a few $100,000 a month in reimbursements for these community organizations. We just crossed $5 million in reimbursements. So that's $5 million in new funds to directly fund services in our region. And those reimbursements go to each of those human service organizations when they complete a service and bill for it. We also have over 3,000 participants now in the region that are receiving services. And those are typically family services. So even though we have 3,000, we know that many more people are being affected. For example, if you have, again, a child in a household and the household is identified as needing greater access to healthy foods, then the food box that's received serves the whole household, not just that individual child. So those numbers are growing and those funds are starting to stabilize. We know we have a lot of work to do in making sure that our community-based organizations are being funded for the true cost of care. That is a lifelong issue for all of medical services and how Medicaid reimburses. So we know that we're snapping on a critical intervention to a system that was already a bit dysfunctional. And so we are trying to do the best we can to stabilize with other funding sources and really make sure we know what the real cost of doing business is for HSOs.
Lori, I want to talk a little bit more about the funding of this. You mentioned that it brought in, and it sounds exciting, brought in, you know, around $5 million in reimbursement funds, and then, you know, 3,000 members you're serving. And so at this point in time, what are some of the challenges that you're running into?
The fun of a pilot demonstration project is that we root out the problems as often as we can, because our intent is for this to become standard practice. We never want to unwind social health needs from clinical health needs, because they aren't for our people, for our members. There is no unwinding them. And so some of the hardest parts, I think, about this pilot have really been about the sort of technology infrastructure and asking folks to change their workflows. So those are the two big chunks I would call out. And really, nobody's ever done this before. It's complicated, and there are great technology solutions out there for a lot of different things, and none of them quite fits perfectly. So we're always trying to improve and amend. And one of those that is has done astounding work in our state and others and is still really difficult to use sometimes is called NC Cares 360. I think a lot of folks who listen to this will have had some interaction with that, because it is a platform meant to connect people with resources. It was created by a company called Unite Us, and they came from a perspective of trying to connect veterans with services, because that is another medical social world that is not well interconnected. And so what the platform is intended to do is something called a closed loop referral. When someone sends a referral out, then we hear what happens and it comes back around to the person who sent it. So historically with social health, it would be something like in your doctor's office, they'd give you a flyer for a local food pantry and say, you should really check this out. But then they'd have no way of knowing if you ever connected with that. And so with NC Cares, they'll actually send a referral. It's a digital referral that goes to the care manager and then to the community-based organization. And I realized, you know, wave at me, I'm doing the bad thing where I say a lot of acronyms. I heard myself say HSO. That is a human service organization. That's another word for community-based organizations. There's a lot of jargon in this. Once you get into the Centers for Medicaid, Medicare Services, I think we speak in more alphabet than we do real words. But all that to say is that it's a complex platform that's used for referral and now for billing as well. So our human service organizations use the referral to then drop a claim that is then paid by the insurance companies. And that process is very complex. We know that in a doctor's office, we need to have staff wholly dedicated to billing because it is so complex.
So the insurance companies pay that claim now, and they're using Medicaid funds to do that, right?
That's it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And so we're able to work out the kinks without it sort of falling on the shoulders of the insurance companies, which I think is an important way to show them that this is effective, because that's a different model for them as well, to use these different types of funds to serve non-medical needs. And with that technology at the center, we're asking almost everyone involved to change the way they operate. So historically, we have these organizations, and again, something that I am really grateful for and will hang on to with all my strength is that this program invested in existing community-based organizations. We didn't stand up a whole bunch of different food pantries and things like that, because these organizations know this community in Western North Carolina, and they have been doing this work, many of them, for generations. And one of the moves in this space sort of was to stop means testing people. If someone comes to your food pantry and tells you they're hungry, they're hungry. Not a lot of people scamming for food pantry food. And it's humbling to walk into a space and say, I need help. And so now we've asked them to shift and say, are you Medicaid eligible? Because if you are, then we could get you more consistent services, and we can draw down funds to support our organization to make sure we can keep doing this in the community. And so now we're asking all of these organizations basically to screen folks, which I will say they're doing beautifully, because no one can do a kinder, gentler connection to a massive federal system than a community leader, somebody who's been doing this work, an organizer, a community health worker. But then we're also asking all these other folks to change their workflows as well. And
yeah, how's that going? Because I could see there's a lot of, especially in the private sector folks, from the providers, the plans. How are they all playing well or not playing well together?
I think everybody really cares about this and is trying, and it's still hitting road bumps occasionally with the need to be very precise in approvals and how the funds flow. We're all very aware as well that eyes are on us, and we don't want any fraud, waste, and abuse to ever crop up in this. So there's a lot of compliance work, and that's the responsibility of the network lead. That's something that we work closely with our HSOs to ensure that all of their billing details are correct. At the insurance level, they're trying to integrate this into their systems so that for the long term, it'll be functional. And that's been pretty bumpy, because this new platform doesn't always speak the same language. Many of our, you know, folks who've been working in insurance or in billing for decades recognize where the opportunities are. So there's a lot of work still being done. You know, that awful old adage, building the plane while we're flying it. We absolutely are with respect to the technology. The care managers have been incredible. It's almost like they were waiting for today to come, that they have known for years how effective it would be if they could draw the whole thread together. There's an organization based in Asheville that serves Western North Carolina called Mission Health Partners. And we get to work with some really incredible folks over there who were already doing this work some of the way in referrals, but with no surety that someone on the other end was going to pick up the phone and take the work. And they do, our community organizations do as much as they can, as often as they can, but this brings a new level of consistency that allows our care managers to really connect all these dots.
So it seems like this is where the job creation was coming from, is that through the process of identifying these needs, then the community groups say, we need more resources to do this. Do they have to go and get grant funding, or is the idea that somehow Medicaid would come in and start to fund some of their staff, or how are you seeing that playing out?
Thankfully, that's a known issue, is sort of lowering the entry cost for all of these organizations. So the initial waiver that we received had associated capacity building dollars, that's what they call it. And we use those for the first couple of years to start training technical assistants and staffing up. And then there are also upfront costs. So there are direct costs associated with repairing a vehicle or purchasing food to be redistributed. And so we were able to pull those capacity building dollars into the region. And to date, that's a little over $12 million that have been distributed across the region. We did just get word that we'll be given a little bit more capacity building through the end of this waiver to keep supporting, because if you can sort of visualize, there was an expectation that that first infusion of capacity building dollars would be high. And as those dollars started to be spent down, the reimbursements would go up. And so those two lines sort of cross in the middle, so that at some point the reimbursements would be enough to cover the cost of doing business. We're not quite there yet. We're still learning about the real cost of doing business, because again, this is a model shift. So our organizations know really well what it costs to do this without a means testing and without invoicing or billing. But there are real direct and indirect costs associated with this newer line of business. And that sort of another really important piece or space that we're in right now is that we're actually in the last, we'll start in October, the last year of this initial waiver. These waivers typically go about 5 years. So this one is set to expire at the end of October in 2024. And so there's been a lot of conversation, and the state is committed to applying for a second waiver, asking for CMS to support us in doing more exploration for another 5 years. So that would run from November of 2024 through October of 2029.
So one of the things that I could see them asking, and kind of we've talked about the show this way, is tell us the stories about how people's lives are improving. You've talked about a lot about the process measures, like, are they getting more food? Are they getting a ride? Are they becoming in some way more productive? Are their health outcomes becoming measurably better? What's the story you would tell about that?
Our access at the network level is more on the interpersonal level. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of the stories about how it has fundamentally changed people's lives, their experience, their belief in support, and that when they ask for help, they may get it, and that people see them and they feel supported. I saw a note come in earlier this week that said, I got my first food box on Friday and it felt like a miracle. So we know that it is changing the way people are, and we know that it's reducing stress in households, because they can count on this. It's consistent. It's always coming to support them. We know anecdotally that it's improving health outcomes. There is the phenomenal woman named Marilyn who tells her story that she and her family were living in a household together. She was in school, I think nursing school, and it was not safe housing. The floor was on top of dirt floors. So there were floors, but there was nothing dividing them. So they had a lot of mildew and dust and those sorts of things. They live close to a river. And so when the water came up, they ended up with a rat infestation in their household. They had young children. And so this was one of those where it was word of mouth. Someone said, you know, I think you ought to look into this program. I think it might help you. And this is a family that, you know, has been keeping it together. They've been, you know, keeping their nose just above water. But to have this resource come in at the right time, they were able to get out of that housing and into safe housing affordably. I think everybody knows if you try to move, it's first and last month's rent and security deposit. You have to have like half the year saved up before you can even try to make the move. So Healthy Opportunities helps defer those costs to get you into the safer housing. You know, folks can often afford the new rent, but they can't afford the startup. And that's where Healthy Opportunities comes in. And so she has finished that degree. Her child, who was navigating asthma attacks, is no longer experiencing those. So, you know, those are places where we can really quickly see positive health outcomes and decreased healthcare spending. You know, a child with uncontrolled asthma in a place with a lot of environmental triggers, they're going to end up at the emergency room pretty regularly. And that's not happening anymore. So we have these anecdotal stories. I can't tell you, I can roll them up into a ball and say that everybody who's getting this is getting support. There's another gentleman who came out of some difficult heart issues and started to get his food box delivery. And now he walks out to meet them. So he's becoming more mobile. He's lost some weight. His heart metrics are down. So again, we hear these stories all the time. We hear folks talk about the respect and dignity of this program, that the people that connect with them see them and have real connections with them. We're actually hearing it from the HSO side too, that they feel the staff of our community-based, our human service organizations, that this work is fulfilling to them, that they feel like they're really a part of creating a thriving community, and it matters to them. And it sustains the work. Sometimes it can be hard to work in nonprofit spaces where you never have enough resources and there's so much need, it can be overwhelming. And then to have a really stable program like this can support you in your work too.
One of the reasons Medicaid is so controversial is, you know, who pays for this and what's it going to, and it doesn't reimburse very well. And what do you expect there to be more scrutiny around the measures? Because in some circles you hear Medicaid and you think, well, shouldn't these people be working? Are they just taking advantage of the system? Do you expect there to be more pushback?
Yeah, I think it's going to be critical. It's really tough for me not to have my hands on those claims. My background is in research and I just really want to see it. I have a lot of confidence because the evidence shows that we will see these improvements. But with social drivers, often the investments weren't made when some of our members were young. And so now they're experiencing chronic health issues that could have been improved by safe housing or access to food when they were young. And so in some cases, we're paying twice, right? We're trying to invest in stabilizing social health right now, but that doesn't mean that folks no longer need metformin for their diabetes or that they no longer need physical therapy for a low back pain that could have been resolved. So I think it's going to be tough for us to show true cost savings with this investment, but we're committed to long-term tracking. So for example, some of the younger people that are getting interventions, are they graduating from high school? Because, you know, again, I always use the asthma one. I'm sure I did it last time we were together because it's so present. When you're a child that's experiencing regular asthma attacks, you're going to the emergency room at night. You're exhausted. You're not going to school the next day. Your mom's not going to work. So you're both missing days in school, days in work. So that might make the household income less secure, which, by the way, many of our Medicaid families have working members in the household. It just means that there's not enough. There's not enough to go around. And so they're going to stay in school. They're not going to miss so many days. They're going to be more likely to graduate, less likely to get justice involved over the course of their lifetime. So we are optimistic that with this second waiver, that'll give us a 10-year window that could really allow us to look at some of these places outside of health insurance. Is CMS, the Center for Medicaid, Medicare Services, interested in that? I'm not sure. I think people are, but systems maybe not so much.
One of the things that strikes me about this program is if you look at the way people with more means function, they have access to their own network of these, of some version of these social programs. They can buy groceries, for example. They can go to the doctor. They can drive their car. And if you look at the health outcomes of people who can afford those things, they tend to be better. So the irony to me is that we already kind of know that by giving people access to these resources, they should have better outcomes. And there's just this resistance to that. It's like, we already do this. We just don't do it for poor people. We've been talking about what the program is and the processes related to it, some of the challenges and how it's measured, how it's working. So Lori, what's next?
I'm hoping you'll let me stay on the topic of poverty just for a minute as we went into the break.
Let's talk about poverty.
Medicaid is shown to be one of the best ways out of poverty. It's a real investment in the social systems of American citizens. It helps people be well enough to do the things that they want to do, to graduate from school, to get a job that is fulfilling and meets their basic needs. And so an investment in Medicaid is one of the best ways to disrupt cycles of poverty. And so when we think about access to basic human needs, we know their health outcomes are going to be better, but so too are any number of other outcome measures, again, with respect to academic attainment. We know that sick kids can't learn. We know that hungry kids can't learn. And so if they have those basic needs met, they're going to thrive in an academic setting and have what they need to then contribute. We know that social drivers have direct and indirect impact. So again, let's say a kid has enough to eat to do really well, take in those math lessons and then perform well on a test, and then they graduate. We know that the farther you go in educational attainment, the better your health outcomes are. And it's really for two reasons in the research. One is that you will very directly get a better job. You're more likely to have private health insurance that gets you more access to the things that you need. You're more likely to have better housing and all of those. The indirect is that you're building your social network. So if something does go off the rails, you get in a car accident that's unexpected, you have more people that you've collected over the years that can show up with a casserole that you don't have the capability of cooking anymore and, you know, can help connect you, drive you to that next doctor's appointment.
Yeah. And the thing that I think I want people, I'm going to interrupt for just a second.
Please.
The thing that I want people to think about is imagine not having that friend who can come over in a time of need. Maybe it's take care of the kids. Maybe it's take the kids to school. Maybe it's wherever. And it's exactly what you're talking about. You have this network. A lot of times it's built in by where the kids go to school. Maybe it's built in from if you're a young person, maybe it's built in from high school or college or wherever. But those networks exist for folks who have more of the means.
That's absolutely right. And it's one of the things that's so important to us about the Healthy Opportunities demonstration is that we are building that network for folks, with folks. I shouldn't say for folks. We are, when someone puts their hands up and says, yes, please, I could use some support to help my family to get what we need to thrive. And then they become connected with organizations that are already doing that and already understand what it means. And I would say more often than not, the employees of these community-based organizations have been there. Recently, they know what it takes to ask for help, and then they know what it takes to accept help. Both of those things are incredibly humbling. And I think that's something that we also, those of us that have everything that we need privately, don't experience very often, the humbleness of asking for help.
Right. So do the members connect ever? I mean, in other words, like experiences, they're often need the same things, transportation, food. Is there any building of a social network there?
You know, that's a great idea. It's something we haven't towed into. One of the sort of barriers with this idea of medicalizing social health needs is that it becomes a medical service. And so HIPAA prevents us at the network from making those connections. But I'm going to ask that question. I want to know that now from our community organizations. What's it looking like when folks are getting connected? You know, we have the examples of the between connections from the members and the staff at the community organizations. But that's a great question about how they might connect with one another.
Well, and if that's valuable, you know, is that the kind of thing, you know, because it's valuable for other people who have more means, you know, that's kind of how the network works, is it's a social network on some level. So I'm just curious as to whether or not there's that opportunity, but it may not be because, again, they don't have the resources. So that network, the utility of the network may not be as powerful. So when you think about other advancements as you go forward, what are some of the things you're looking forward to and most excited about?
One is greater access, expanding eligibility. So I think when I was here in February, we talked to, it's a narrow slice. So it wasn't all Medicaid members that are eligible for this. So the first gate was that you had to have managed care, which not all folks had access to at the beginning of Medicaid transformation. And then you had to have two chronic conditions that could be helped by a social need. So there were several gates. We're cracking those gates open. So there's been a lot of advocacy work locally and at the state level. So this coming winter, all so Medicaid Direct will become eligible. So that includes folks who will eventually be a part of another managed care program called Tailored Plans. Those are folks with intellectual developmental disability, complex mental health, healthcare needs, and substance use disorders. Are all those groups are not currently eligible, and we have so much need to invest there. We know that all of those issues, or all of those identified groups, have social health needs, and that their health outcomes are maybe even more exacerbated by lack of access to healthy food and safe housing and a social network. So expanding our eligibility pool is incredibly exciting to us and to the community organizations who are doing this work, to know that right now folks are getting turned away and in just a couple of months they're going to be eligible. I'm really excited about that. The other piece is that we're going to spend this year really focused on financial sustainability. That does not sound exciting, but from somebody who spent 20 years in nonprofit, it is incredibly exciting. We want to make sure that these community organizations are thriving and doing this work for as long as it's needed in our communities, and that they're doing it in a way that is lower stress. Think about your family household finances. They're doing that at an organizational level to make sure that there's enough food and enough staff and all of that, to make sure that these services keep going. So we're going to be working on what those financial models look like to make sure that the network is thriving. And then at Impact Health, we're actually going through a strategic planning process right now to figure out what our role is in this region. Right now, it's very specifically this Medicaid project, but we believe that all individuals should have access to a coordinated, person-centered care approach. And we want to think about what our role can be in ensuring that that happens in our region, regardless of insurance status.
So, have you gotten any feedback from the managed care organizations, providers in the medical community? What does their engagement look like?
I think we're so in the weeds with some of our colleagues at the insurance companies that it's more about, have we figured out the solution yet? But again, the folks that we work with every day are really excited about this, and it's really a seismic shift. We don't get to see those a lot in healthcare. You know, the Affordable Care Act, seismic shift. Investing in social health, seismic shift. So on that side, I would say we're in it together. It's like being in a scrum. With the other groups, there's so much opportunity to make this system function for people in a way that it never has before. And I'm going to admit to losing my train of thought there. There was a second part of your question that was really exciting, and I've already lost it.
I was talking about the engagement of plans, which you've kind of covered, the medical community.
Medical community. Yeah. That's what I wanted to talk about. So we have a partnership with some really great folks over at MAHEC, the Mountain Area Health Education Center. And that MAHEC was originally founded as a medical field education center to make sure that folks had up-to-speed professional development. And they also, of course, provide direct clinical care now, and they host medical residencies. So we're seeing the future of the medical field there, and we're engaging them in this process. And so there's a group that does practice engagement. So all of the practices that are supported by MAHEC around the region, we're helping to train and educate them about this project. And one of the areas that has been on my mind for a long time, I worked at Mission Health System years and years ago, is the stress and burnout in the medical field. So you have, for the most part, folks who went into medicine because they want to help people be well. And over the years, they see that the medical interventions don't have as much impact as they could because basic needs are not being met. And so it chips away at their sort of reason for being in the field. And some folks, it makes them experience depression and anxiety. Other folks get there's a phrase for it that I won't come up with right now, but it sort of makes them cold. It's just too much. You have to put up a barrier between you and the trauma that folks are experiencing. And in some extreme cases, we see relatively higher than the regular population rates of suicide in the medical field. And that's only gotten worse during the COVID years. And so one of my hopes is that we'll actually see improved job satisfaction in the medical field when they can see that their patients' needs are being met, and that they can then take that next step in intervening with clinical approaches when they know that there is safe housing.
It would give you a lot more confidence that you know it needs to be done for someone, and that it's beyond a clinical solution. It's a social solution. So I could see that being a real weight off of folks' shoulders. Are you aware of any other programs across the country that work this way? Just to kind of recap for a minute, you know, Healthy Impact is like the organizer, the convener of all of this. And you talked about these care managers and these who come from different organizations, disparate organizations. Then you have the actual service providing community organizations. Are you aware of any other initiative like this related to Medicaid in the United States?
We're building momentum. I got to be on a call last week that was organized by some national funders for some other states that are doing this work. So North Carolina has a claim that we're the first ones to do it the way we're doing it. Right. So to use...
What makes it unique?
It's these components of the network lead. So this model of organizing our community-based organizations so that it gives a little bit of a buffer. So yes, we're asking them to change a bit of the way that they provide services, but we're not asking them to be as deep into the red tape that is a federal healthcare program. So the network lead is pretty unique to
us. And that's
us.
Healthy Impact. That's your organization.
Yeah, that's okay. Impact Health. And then there Impact are two Health, others. So North Carolina has three regions for this pilot program. So there's Access East and sort of the northeastern part of the state. They're based in Greenville, North Carolina. And then there is Community Care for Lower Cape Fear, which is based in Wilmington, North Carolina. So I have two peer organizations, and we are constantly troubleshooting all of this stuff together. They're two really incredible leaders over there. But one of the things that we're looking at as a state is with this waiver renewal, we want to be in all 100 counties. And so... That will be a unique opportunity to be fully statewide. Other states that are doing this work that I was able to listen in on are doing it in somewhat different ways. So Texas has some work going on around social health. Some of it is state legislation, state funded. They're working more with community health workers to make connections between clinical and social health needs. Washington State has just had a waiver approved to dig into this. So they're in the very early stages, but they've got really great work starting to come. Rhode Island has done this in a state and local funding model. And New Jersey, I believe, was the other group on the call. So momentum is building. And so when I say we have hit a tipping point, I don't think we'll ever go back to a place where the clinical world can ignore social health. But I think we're going to go through a lot of iterations until we figure out the best way to do this that gets to the best outcomes at the lowest cost with the sort of least complex approach. Right now, things are quite complex.
So what kinds of things would you ask us to all be thinking about and or doing?
I think there are a couple of layers to that. The sort of the interpersonal is to talk about how important systems of service like this are for everyday people. I think we can get a little jaded about government intervention, but the best way to use, in my opinion, large-scale federal dollars is to invest in systems like this. So really talking about the importance of a system like this that can really help people and change lives. So thinking about how government functions and why it functions is really important to understanding how Medicaid changes lives. So thinking about those and having real conversations about what this means. I think for decades we've been sort of keeping arm's length from things like Medicaid and SNAP, which is, you know, supplemental nutrition. And it feels like this bad thing in that if you accept it, it's bad. So talking about stigma is something I would ask everybody to do.
Well, I think one of the key things is really, I think in the past people think about Medicaid as dollars being given to someone and wiping your hands of it. And I think what the pilot is showing is the importance of that network. And if people start to think about this, their own system they were probably born into, in a lot of cases, it becomes easier to understand. It's like, oh, I would kind of be a little lost if I couldn't go to the grocery store and get food, or I couldn't take my car in, or I didn't have a car, or maybe two cars, or I didn't have a friend who could take my kids to school. You know, you take all these things for granted, and then they start to add up and go, imagine yourself without two of those things, three of those things during the day. You couldn't get to the doctor to get your prescription. That means you're stuck at home getting worse. You end up in the ER. Imagine that being your life.
Yeah.
And so I feel like one of the things this is really helpful is for people to understand that's the system. It's the system that a lot of people take for granted that your organization is having to build for people who didn't grow up with that kind of thing.
That's exactly it. It's really a practice in empathy building that these are basic human needs that are being met. And I think if you want to take it even a little bit further is that healthy communities are a social good. It is good for me that you have enough healthcare, that you are able to access the things that you need so that we can be in thriving community together. And all of those things that we talk about, so making sure that a child is healthy enough to then be well educated so that, you know, maybe that kid that's not getting enough to eat is going to unlock the thing that changes how we cure cancer. I know that people sort of throw that around a lot, but it's real. And we're limiting our potential when we don't make sure that basic human needs are being met so that folks can go on to thrive and build a better space.
Well, even if you have one child who gets an education who is productive, would you rather have that or someone who's homeless and in prison or on drugs? So that's a simple equation, is why wouldn't you invest in productivity as opposed to just assuming the worst? You know, we talk a lot about positive intent these days. That's like the buzzword going around, is positive intent. Well, why don't you just assume that people want to be productive? Let's go back to that. Do you feel like people do?
Absolutely. The things we hear all the time are about how this small thing, and it maybe feels small to you or I, that, you know, getting a produce delivery on a Friday afternoon is life-changing. And talking about the brain space that it frees up. I don't have to worry about whether or not I'm going to have enough to feed my kids this weekend. They get their meals at school all week. That's lower stress. And then this food box comes on Fridays, and I know I can get through the weekend. So I'm going to be able to do what I need to do. I'm going to be able to work. I'm going to be able to do all of these tasks that maybe I would have spent all that time and energy trying to figure out where the food is going to come from this week. So really, people are saying that it frees up space for them to do what they want to do. You know, one example was the woman we talked about earlier, who once they were in safe housing and she wasn't spending all of her time and energy removing dust and catching rats and, you know, that the river was pushing out. She finished school. She's got a degree. She's working in the community now. And I expect we'll probably leave this program behind in the near future.
Yeah, one of the things that I just thought of is that when you free people up to not think about basic necessities, they do become more productive and they can innovate and learn. And just what you're describing is a perfect example of it. I would almost say, you know, in corporate America, there's a lot of complaints about meetings and time. I don't have time to think. And imagine that being your life without basic needs. And that's exactly the situation, is if once you free someone's time from doing things that they have to do, not that they want to do, they become far, far more productive. Thank you very, very much. So join us next week for another illuminating episode of Solutions for the Underaffiliated. We'll be talking with Tyler Malone, a health services research investigator and data analyst at the Shep Center, which you mentioned earlier today, which is part of University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And he's going to be talking about the health in rural areas. Till then, a reminder to check out all of our podcasts of this show at underaffiliated.com and stream Asheville FM live from the site or the app whenever and wherever you are. Lori, thanks again.
Thank you, Eric, for highlighting this. It's
all right
to be here.
Have a great day, everybody.